I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The Orange County Public School System identified 7,200 homeless students in the district last school year. Christina Savino, the school district's homeless education liaison, is working to provide assistance to those students and their families. I'll speak with Christina about how school districts are coping with a growing homeless student population. Also, Seminole County has joined 16 other counties to appeal a ruling won by online travel companies about the taxes they pay on the hotel rooms they sell. I'll speak with UCF's Rosen College of Hospitality Management Dean Abraham Pizam about the debate and the lawsuit. And later in the program, 90.7's Amy Green talks with Senior Pastor Joel Hunter from Central Florida's Northland Church about the environmental movement and the evangelical church. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Christina Savino. Christina is the Orange County Public Schools Homeless Education Program Specialist. Christina, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Orange County Public School District identified 7,200 homeless students last school year. Before that, it was 4,844, according to some reports, and in 2009, a little over 1,500. Why the increase in numbers?
It's twofold. Obviously, we have a situation going on with our economy. Central Florida hasn't been affected yet with the recovery in the sense that we are very service-oriented industry area with many jobs available, but unfortunately have a low rate of hourly pay for people with those positions to maintain stable housing, affordable housing is very difficult. So we've seen an increase in our homelessness here in Central Florida. The other portion of that is awareness. It takes training of our schools to identify various housing situations. We've put things in place. The awareness is growing. Our families are being more proactive in self-identifying their housing situation because they know the school district can help. So you know, it's economy and awareness.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's also an element of defining what exactly homelessness is, and there may be some, I guess, misconceptions around what exactly defines who is homeless. So how would you define a homeless student?
Every school district in the nation follows the same definition. It's provided in No Child Left Behind. It's federal legislation. And it's any child that lacks a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. So it's a very broad umbrella. Mm-hmm. And then it breaks it down into categories such as those living in abandoned cars and on the streets, abandoned buildings, which is our more traditional view of homelessness, but then it also encompasses those who are living in emergency shelters, transitional housing, hotels and motels due to the lack of a more adequate housing. And then our largest population of identified students are living doubled up or in shared housing of others due to the loss of their own housing and nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. So moving in with aunt, grandma, sister, neighbor, friend, because otherwise they'd be on the street.
And that's been quite common, I think, throughout the country through the recession. It's probably a trend which is going to continue for some time.
Yes. As a nation, we surpassed, I think, last year, over 1 million identified school-age children. So I'm not even talking about the little ones or the recent graduates, just those in school K through 12.
How do you go about identifying those students?
There's a couple ways that we go about identification. Our largest way of identifying is we have something called a residency questionnaire that is implemented as part of the enrollment process as parents come to enroll their children into school. But it's also dispersed to every child in the school in the first weeks of school to identify not only new enrollees, but the kids that have always been with us. So that residency questionnaire goes out, the parents fill it out and turn it back in, and then we assess what those answers were on that questionnaire. But then we do training of our front office staff. They're our front line on working with families, our guidance counselors. We have SAFE coordinators. You know, basically anyone who will listen, we go out to schools and we hold annual trainings as well to talk about identification. But we also work with local service agencies like the shelters. Mm-hmm. And share information as parents release.
So on that that questionnaire, how many students would tick the box saying, like, as a proportion of those 7,200 students, how many would tick the box saying, are you alone without an adult or with an adult who isn't your parent or legal guardian? Because that seems like the most extreme example, I suppose, of somebody who's a homeless student.
Yeah, so... you know, what you're mentioning is what we call an unaccompanied homeless youth. So it's a child that lacks a fixed, regular, adequate nighttime residence, but is not in the presence of a parent or a legal guardian. Youth that have maybe been kicked out, who have run away, aged out of foster care, and are on their own yet still in high school. We had over 200 of those children identified last school year. We think there's more. These would be the teenage couch surfers that are going from friend to friend and sometimes are flying under the radar. But once again, with more awareness and strategies on identification, we hope to identify more of those children so that we can tap them into services.
Is there still quite a lot of stigma around students identifying themselves as homeless?
Yes, absolutely, and families as well. It's a sensitive situation, and because the definition is so broad, some families may not consider themselves as being homeless. So yes, self-identification is tough. We do post public notice. We have posters in our schools and throughout the community to let them know that their school can help them and that their children have certain educational rights afforded to them. But it's not always going to happen that they'll self-identify.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does Orange County rank in the number of homeless students? Because just looking at some stats from the Department of Children and Families, some 63,000-odd students are listed as homeless statewide. Where does Orange County fit within that continuum?
Well, last school year, we were number one with the number of homeless students. Does that mean we have more than other counties? Maybe not. It's the identification piece. So these are the ones that we know of. In the past, we have been just behind Dade County in Miami. Mm-hmm. But once again, last school year with our identification efforts, we were number one.
And the teachers, they're being trained in how to spot a kid who might be homeless and get them the help they need. Has that been a difficult process too, getting sort of teachers accustomed to picking somebody who's homeless and then figuring out how to go about getting them help?
It is a lot. You know, how do you push one priority above all the other priorities that we have going on? And of course, as the school district, education is our main purpose, but it is important to understand the housing circumstance and where the children are coming from so that we can help eliminate barriers to that education, help them overcome those challenges. So it is difficult. With Orange County specifically, we're the fourth largest school district in Florida, the 11th largest in the nation. So going out and training teachers means going to over 200 schools. But we're getting there.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of help does the school district offer the students and families?
The school district can offer school stability when their housing is unstable. So if they enroll into a school, they can stay in that same school even if they're moving from place to place to place. Above and beyond just being able to stay in that school, we can provide district transportation to stay in that same school, because that would be a major barrier to remaining in the same school if they didn't have a way to get there. Mm-hmm. So we provide school buses for any child over 2 miles from that school. We cross county lines keeping children in the same school because at the end of the day, keeping their education stable will help them in the long run. And then free meals. We have free breakfast and lunch at school. Expedited immediately when we identify a situation, no application needed. And then we do have some set-aside funding, federal funding, and we write grants and work off of donations to help these children participate fully in school and school activities. So field trips and eyeglasses and bus passes so that the parent can go to the parent-teacher conference night for that parent involvement piece. A lot of those supplementary support systems we can help put in place.
Mm-hmm. What about emotional challenges for homeless students? What kind of challenges are they facing?
You know, emotionally, it takes a toll, and I can't say that I am an expert on that. Definitely, our guidance counselors and our SAFE coordinators and our professionals in the schools have that more one-on-one contact. But they're constantly surrounded by stress, stress in the home. And we know as adults what stress does to us, even physically. So growing up in that kind of environment can't be a good thing.
Now, when you talk about making homelessness more visible and being able to deal with it on that level, I know that some schools in Orange County, for example, Fern Creek Elementary, they have a fairly high homeless population. Are those schools kind of like a model for other schools to, you know, if they have a large proportion of homeless students, they look to, say, Fern Creek and say, look, this is what they've done. We can follow a similar pattern.
Yeah, Fern Creek Elementary is the zoned school for the Coalition for the Homeless. So they have had years of experience with students experiencing homelessness in that traditional definition of living in a homeless shelter. And so they have done amazing things with rallying community support and doing weekend food bags and clothing, and absolutely would serve as a model for other schools with a similar population.
Mm-hmm. What about the funding? Now, I know that funding support for helping homeless students comes from the federal government under the McKinney-Vento Act. Is there a proportion of homeless funding that comes from the state government as well?
Well, Title I federal programs is required to set aside funding for homeless whether or not they're in a Title I school. And Title I would be based on poverty percentages per school. So whether you're in an affluent school or a Title I school, Title I must set aside funding for homeless students. But there is no mandated calculation of what that is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's county by county, district by district. It's in between the Title I director and the homeless liaison on how that works out. And then, yes, we do get funding through the McKinney-Vento Act. But I will say that you mentioned how our numbers have grown. Actually, when I started in 2006, we had 123 identified students. And now here we are last school year with over 7,000.
Mm-hmm.
The money has stayed the same each school year. It has not increased. So we've had to be more creative in what we're doing and reaching out once again to the community and business partners to help supplement for our growing problem here. And then, small grants, things of that nature.
As far as the funding goes, I mean, that's a pretty huge increase in demand for that fixed pool of money. Do you think the federal government needs to have another look at this, or maybe even the state government? Is this something you would like to see Florida lawmakers take another look at and say, look, we've got a big problem here. We just need some more money for it?
Absolutely, because some of the mandates through the law are unfunded. The transportation to stay in the school of origin, there is no money that goes to that. You just absorb it. Well, that alone is hundreds of thousands of dollars just in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a strain on the school district, yet it's the right thing to do. So we're going to do what we can for these kids. But funding would definitely help increase services, increase academic achievement, get these kiddos to graduation. And at the end of the day, that's the key of breaking the cycle.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you see this playing out over the coming years? Obviously, your methods of identifying homeless kids are getting better. Maybe there's because there are now more identified homeless children, maybe the stigma will start to wear off a little bit and more people will come forward. But do you see that number just growing year on year, or do you think you'll be able to kind of wrap it up at some point?
My hope is to see it decrease.
Sure.
At some time. You know, every year we have 500 to 1,000 more kids than we had the year before. I'm looking forward to the day that that plateaus off and starts decreasing, that there's more affordable housing in our community or higher paying jobs. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been speaking to Christina Savino. She's the Orange County Public Schools Homeless Education Program Specialist. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Up next, UCF's Rosen College of Hospitality Management Dean Abraham Pizan talks about the online hotel tax debate. I'm joined in the studio now by Abraham Pizan. He's the Dean of the Rosen College of Hospitality Management at the University of Central Florida. Dean Pizan, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Well, to begin to understand what this case is about, we have to, I guess, understand how these travel companies work. These online companies, they're buying en masse, so they're paying less per, say, bed than you would if you were just an average run-of-the-mill consumer.
Of course, especially in a hotel.
Sure.
They would get a very significant discount. Mm-hmm. They would charge a premium, of mm-hmm. course, that's their profit, in order to make some money out of the whole transaction. And the customer will pay most of the time, not always, but most of the time it will pay less than had the customer gone directly to the hotel. So there is a tax on it. The question whether it's on the price that the online is buying or the price that the online is charging the customer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between the two prices that are charged the tax.
So for the customer, it really makes no difference. They don't, you know, they're not really aware of the proportion of the money they're paying that goes towards funding the local counties. They're simply paying out of pocket.
Absolutely. They couldn't care less. They mm-hmm. see one price. They compare the prices many times. There is a lot of comparative shopping. They will go, let's say that you want to buy a hotel room, so they will go from site to site to site to site within the same online company, and they will select the one that has the cheapest.
Mm-hmm.
That would have a tax included in it.
Mm-hmm. So how is it that the online companies are able to get away with paying for the price they're buying the tickets for rather than, as the counties are saying, some of the counties at least are saying, the price which they are selling the tickets to the customer for?
Well, that's a question of wholesale or retail.
Mm.
You know, they prefer, to charge one fee, which is added to the price, and the customer gets the benefit. In their opinion, that's the customer who's benefiting because it's cheaper. Of course, if you have to add tax to the price that the customer pays, of course it will be more expensive and it will be more difficult for them to compete with the other methods of purchasing.
How long is this fight over what online travel companies should pay in terms of tax? How long has it been going on for?
Oh, it's at least 4 or 5 years. Not on this particular issue, whether it should be charged on the net or growth, but in principle, whether they should pay taxes, it's been going for some time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a view on it, Professor? I mean, do you think it's fair that the online company should be paying less?
Well, there's the whole issue of what taxes should people pay for internet purchases.
Mm-hmm.
It goes beyond travel. It goes anything else. You buy yourself a piece of furniture, which normally, if you would have bought it in this county, you pay 6 or 6.5%, and then you buy it online, you pay no taxes whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, does online compete fairly with offline? Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, they have an advantage. Now, they have an advantage because of historical reasons where you wanted to encourage sales online. But is it time to levy taxes in a fair way so they could compete on the same level of every other store or every other company that has a physical presence? Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it's time for them to do it. But that's up to Congress. That's a federal issue.
Is it something that could also be settled at the state level?
True. But then you have variance from state to state, and people can easily cross the border in some states and purchase it in another state mm-hmm. and avoid the taxes. So I think the best solution would be on a federal level that everybody has the same policy and the same rate.
Mm-hmm. Now, Seminole County is one of 17 counties that is still fighting to get some of this tax back, and the county has an 11% hotel tax. Do you know what kind of money they're hoping to get with a decision in their favor in the Supreme Court?
I have no idea what they would settle for. I think that sooner or later they will settle the way others have done rather than go to court mm-hmm. and incur all those additional costs. Plus, who knows what the court might decide, you know, not only in terms of in their favor or not, but they might decide on a sum which is lower than, you know, what they might get in a settlement. So I think that they are kind of positioning themselves to fight, and sooner or later they'll come to some understanding.
Do you think, and just referring back to what you said about it really needs to be settled on a nationwide basis rather than county by county or even state by state, how likely is that to happen, do you think?
Let me put it this way. It's more likely to happen today than it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago. There is a movement in Congress, and there is a movement on a nationwide level for creating a uniform system rather than a patchwork of different counties and different states, each one ruling in their own favor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more likely.
So this current case before the Supreme Court, do you think there is some compelling evidence to rule in favor of the counties, or do you think it'll go the way of cases in the appellate court?
What I think, and I'm not privy to the internal discussion that go between the parties, you know, behind the scenes, so forth. I'm sure that there is some kind of negotiations. While the court proceedings are going on, there are negotiations between the two parties to reach a settlement. And I think that looking at some other counties, both in Florida and outside of Florida, that have done it, there is precedent. And there is an understanding by the online companies that sooner or later, if they don't settle, they may lose.
Mm-hmm.
So they are interested in settling, and I think so are the counties.
And do you get the sense that this may be the end of the line as far as these cases go? You said they've been, you know, this has been sort of waged, this battle has been waged for four or five years now.
Oh, yeah. And once you see the larger counties settling with these nationwide companies like Expedia and Travelocity, Orbitz, others would follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
So sooner or later, you will see the majority of the states and majority of the counties within the states will settle on it.
I've been speaking to Abraham Pizam. He's the Dean of the Rosen College of Hospitality Management at the University of Central Florida. Dean Pizam, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, 90.7's Amy Green speaks with Pastor Joel Hunter about evangelicals and the environment. Joel Hunter is the senior pastor at Northland, a church distributed in Longwood. He's prayed with President Barack Obama and lobbied Congress on climate change, and he also narrated a documentary released by Northland earlier this year.
For many, the flashpoint becomes a dialogue about what God meant when he gave us dominion over the animals on the earth. But God has plenty to say about how we exhibit dominion throughout the Bible. It's not just about our right to use it, but how we use it.
Our Father's World is intended as a resource for the 20,000 congregants at the megachurch and other faith-based and environmental groups. Pastor Hunter sat down with 90.7's Amy Green recently to talk about the evangelical movement and the environment.
Well, first of all, any passage that you use out of Scripture needs to be informed by the other passages that relate to it. That was preceded by God's order when he put Adam and Eve into the garden to cultivate it, put Adam into the garden, to cultivate it and to keep it. The Hebrew words are avad and shamar. It means to bring out that which is not there, but to protect that which is there. In other words, protect it from pollution. So the very first order we had from God was take care of the earth, don't pollute it. Protect. You have to protect it. It's a continuing resource. Then it goes on to say that he multiplied the human beings on the face of the earth and gave them dominion. Now, this word dominion is an interesting word because many people take that as a right to exploit the earth. But the word actually in Hebrew and in the context means to be a servant of or to serve. In other words, to use it in a responsible way so that it benefits from the use as well as you benefit from its use. And so that word has really been taken in ways that it was not meant in Scripture to be taken.
Now, the documentary makes a biblical and evangelical case for environmentalism. And this has been an issue that in the past, evangelicals have really not been very active on. How is that changing now?
Evangelicals, you know, we belong to a community where our emphasis is saving souls. You know, we want people to go to heaven. And so we tell them about Jesus. And part of the downside of that is that we focus so much on heaven that we don't focus enough on earth. When it's ironic because God came down to earth, we believe, in Jesus, to make earth better, you know. And we pray, every time we pray his prayer, we say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So part of this is the growing awareness that we're not here just to get people into heaven. We're here to make earth more like heaven and to reflect the glory of God in everything he's given us. And that includes the environment.
And this clearly is an issue that's very important to you. Why is it especially important to you?
I've become more aware of the impact, especially on the poor and the vulnerable throughout the world. I travel the world a lot. And I've actually seen people who cannot sustain their way of life anymore because they haven't, you know, droughts and I see the wars that are going on and it just, I feel responsible.
Where?
Well, for example, the war in Sudan, a lot of people think that's about religion. It's not about religion. It's about the desert that has now come into what before were farming communities. The people who lived in the desert, many of whom happen to be Muslim, are now moving in because they need the sustenance. The people who have lived there before are kind of defending their land, and so it's about economics. It's about, you know, who gets the meager resources as the desert expands because of climate change.
That was 90.7's Amy Green talking to Senior Pastor Joel Hunter from Northland, a church distributed, about the documentary Our Father's World. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.